Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Tom Moran here from Tom's Big Spiders. First of all, an apology for the delay on this one. Basically, we got slammed with a tropical storm yesterday, Tropical Storm Henry, and I did get up nice and early to finish the podcast before the actual storm really ramped up. But unfortunately, as I was sitting here starting to speak, the light started to dim. So I'm like, I've already had it happen once where I was doing a podcast and the power went out in the middle of the podcast and I basically lost the whole thing. I did not want to do that again. So I decided to cut it and start it over again today if we have power. Luckily, we do have power. This is amazing. I think I've alluded to this before, but our last house where we're at was on a hill, a very wooded hill with power lines coming up the hill, and the trees on one side of the hill were all dying. And so basically any time we had the latest bit of a weather event that involved wind, one of those trees would come down, take down the power lines, and because it was only six houses, I think, total on that street, would be like the last people to get power back. So not only would it like happen during, you know, just there'd be a little squall and we'd lose power, but during those big storms, we'd really lose power. So it was nice to be in a place for once that we didn't lose power. And so that's an encouraging sign for us being here. We talked to our neighbor 2 days ago. We were walking and we asked if they lose power here. He's been here for many, many years. And he goes, oh, we almost never lose power here, which is great. So anyway, it was flickering. I didn't want to take the chance. So here we are, Monday morning, last minute one. And unfortunately, the Monday morning of the week I go back to school. Boy, did that summer vacation fly. Billy and I have been trying to sell the old house for the entire break. The closing was finally Friday, so that's gone, but that sapped up a lot of our extra summertime. Apparently, I should be on an episode of Hoarders for the amount of stuff that I've collected because we were in our last house for almost 15 years. I tend to hold on to a lot of things and have a lot of collections. So a lot of the stuff was mine and we had it packed into the attic and it's just been it's been a bit of a nightmare. Moving is not fun and moving after you've already technically moved almost a year earlier is even less fun, but we got it done. The house is sold. So that's, you know, a huge weight off my shoulders because that has been sapping up a lot of my Tom's Big Spider time over the summer, as a matter of fact. So that's out of the way. So exciting news there. Back to school. That kind of stinks. But, you know, don't get me wrong. I enjoy being back into school. I enjoy the routine of things, but I don't feel like I accomplished. Every summer I go on summer break and I have a list of things I want to accomplish. And I looked at the list last night and I got maybe a tenth of the way through it. So, oh well, here's still Christmas break. We'll hopefully get some stuff done. So to kick this one off, I don't like to go back and revisit stuff from, you know, the podcast I did before. However, I kind of have to on this one. I posted the podcast on Sunday that involved blue tarantula updates, and a lot of it focused on two communals I have, the M. balfouri and the P. metallica, which is no more. We split those guys up. But the M. balfouri, I was talking about how I finally caught some pictures of them out, and I would be putting some video up. Well, on Monday, I caught something that I was absolutely shocked that I caught, and I'm telling you, it was so close to me not catching it. So basically what happened was we were doing feeding time, and I fed the balfouris. I take their enclosure out. I put it on my little food cart that I do the feedings on. Opened up, you know, dropped in, I don't know, 15 crickets or so. Closed up, put it back on the shelf. And basically when I do feeding, people are always asking me how I keep track of what I do. I start on one side of the room, on one end of the shelves, and I work my way all the way across the room. And I leave myself a little marker wherever I stop so I know, hey, I stopped at these enclosures here so I can pick up at the same spot the next time. This time I decided to reverse the way I went, so I went the opposite way. So I was feeding the balfouri at the beginning of the room where I usually end up on that area last when I do feedings. So I fed them, went on to the next enclosures, and I just saw something bolt out of the corner of my eye, and I watched two spiders, like, going at it, bolting across the enclosure, one of them chasing the other. I'm like, oh, my Lord. For a second, it took me a moment to figure out the kind of recognize what I was seeing because I didn't register immediately. Oh, that's right. There are multiple tarantulas in this enclosure. I'm like, what is happening here? So then I look, and there's two balfouri faced off. And they went from the left corner of the enclosure almost all the way across, just all the way across the enclosure to the right corner of the enclosure. And then they kind of faced off. Now, there was no threat posturing. It didn't appear to be like, it wasn't a full-blown scuffle. But it was obvious there was a face-off going on. The M. balfouri to the right, the first one, the one that was being chased, basically had parts of a cricket in its mouth. It had eaten a cricket, it had kind of been torn up, and it was obvious that it had already been feeding on it. And the other one was trying to entangle its legs with it. And I realized it was trying to get the cricket from the M. balfouri on the right, which I have seen food fights before. When they were little, I've seen ones, you know, literally they'd both be fighting over a piece of a roach, and one of them would just pull the piece of roach away from the other one. The other one would just kind of wander off dejected and find a different piece. It happened once when they were older, when they were larger specimens. I had a situation where Billy and I were watching them, and I'm like, oh, look, they're all eating it. And one of them tackled the other one, knocked it over onto its back. It landed on top of it. So they're, you know, face to face, and grabbed a cricket from it and then ran away. And the other one got up and again dusted itself off and eventually found another cricket. So we'd seen these, what we jokingly refer to as food fights, before, but I hadn't seen one in a while. These guys have been together for 5 years. I don't see them all out all that much often. And what was intriguing about this one, there's a couple things I just want to, you know, point out. Number one, while they're having their little face off in the corner, there are large crickets walking all around them. This isn't a situation where there wasn't enough food. There were crickets everywhere. At one point, while I was getting my camera going, one of them actually kicked one of the cricket. The one that was trying to get the cricket from the other one's mouth actually kind of knocked the other cricket out of the way, the one that was on the ground. It could have easily have just turned around and grabbed that. So obviously, it was intent on getting that particular cricket from that particular spider at that time. Now, as I get, I freak out. I see them going, I'm like reaching for my phone. My phone was at my table. I run over, grab my phone. It's one of those deals where you're like, you can't get the phone open and on camera mode soon enough. I finally get it on and I managed to catch a good portion of the standoff. So basically what happens is one spider, the spider's coming from the left. That's the one that doesn't have the cricket, is at one point underneath the one on the right, but then it starts to take kind of more of a dominant posture over it, if you will. And it's reaching out with its legs, prodding with its legs. And the other one's kind of trying to hold it off. But then it starts to, you know, it's getting over top of it. And as I'm recording it, I'm thinking to myself, all right, people are going to freak out when they see this. There's going to be people that go, whoa, what if they had just killed each other right there? What if that one had eaten the other one? Not realize they've been together for 5 years. I wasn't really concerned at all that this was going to end in one of them getting injured or dead, quite frankly. It was one of those deals where I was just fascinated by what I was seeing because, you know, again, I have an interpretation of what happened. So the one, we'll call it the dominant one, starts, you know, clawing at it. And I'm like, at least its fangs aren't out. I'm literally thinking how I'm going to narrate this. And I'll be able to say here, notice the fangs aren't out. Well, all of a sudden the fangs start twitching. Like they're moving back and forth. And then it reaches out with its fangs. I'm like, oh dear, this might not be good. And for a split second, like when you see spiders, two spiders, you know, facing off and one of them gets its fangs out, you start to worry. So it kind of goes out and prods with its fangs. And at first it almost looks like it's going for the other spider's leg, but it doesn't. And then it prods with its fangs again. And again, it gets a little closer, but this time you can tell it's not going for the other spider's legs. It's reaching out with its fangs, trying to grab that cricket, trying to grab the prey from the other one's mouth. So I believe, you know, I don't have the video right in front of me now, I believe it does it three times, and on the third time, it goes out and it uses its fangs and basically grabs the cricket right out of the other tarantula's mouth and turns around and walks away. Amazing, amazing footage, because there are a lot of things happening here. And again, I'm not a scientist. I'm not an arachnologist. I have spoken to people before that study arachnids. I have spoken to people that Dr. Linda Rayner, who we spent some time with a couple years ago, right before the pandemic, as a matter of fact, but she's at Cornell University and she has an interest in communal properties in arachnids. You know, we've chatted before about it. So, you know, I'm not a scientist, flat out. And I want to make that very clear, because sometimes people share stuff like this on certain boards or whatnot, and there are certain people that are just waiting to pounce on it. Not a scientist, but I'm also not an idiot, and I consider myself to be a fairly well-read, somewhat intelligent guy. We'll go somewhat. But here's my interpretation. Here are some things I noticed about this. Number one, if obviously people abhor, there are people out there that abhor communals because of the risk factor of it. And obviously, there's always that worry that A, it's not going to go well, or B, in the very least, what you're going to end up with is just tarantulas that are tolerating each other. And I agree to some extent that some of the communals we set up, I think they are with species that have learned possibly in nature. It hasn't always been studied in nature, but in nature, that when, you know, the food is scarce or when real estate is scarce, it makes sense for them to tolerate each other rather than to just have hunger games and destroy their whole population by cannibalizing each other. I do think we sometimes exploit that in the communals we set up. So like last week, we talked a lot about Peacelotheria metallica. That's when I think we kind of exploit the fact that they're able to do that. But I do think when you look at some of the stuff we've observed with the M-Balfouri, there is incredibly compelling evidence that they are truly social and communal. And I'll say that. I mean, I'm sorry, proof is in the pudding, and I've seen some crazy, almost miraculous type behavior between these guys that points to that socialization. So when you look at two spiders that are about to fight over food, your thought process immediately goes to, oh, this is going to be one eating the other. I mean, they're not trained, they're not supposed to get along well enough that if there's a skirmish over food, the one isn't going to go to the other one. The heck with this, I don't want the cricket anymore, I want you. We all expect it. There was a split second there when the fangs came out that was like, uh-oh, this might not be good at all. I may be eating, you know, my words as far as the success of this thing. Just a split second. And I was, you know, again, I was able to look back and go, wait a minute, it's not going for the spider. But I think that is huge. The fact that these spiders have that socialization, there has to be some socialistic properties there that they recognize what spider, you know, that we'll call it the dominant spider, recognized it wanted the cricket from the other spider. And it didn't kill it. It went for the cricket. The whole fight was for it to take the cricket from the other one's mouth. That shows some intellect. I'm sorry. We'll call it intellect or some type of reasoning, some type of social reasoning, because it doesn't immediately try to. The easiest thing for it to do would have been to just kill the other spider and eat it. But it didn't want to hurt the other spider. It wanted that prey item. Almost like if you see, you know, I've had dogs before. I had somebody chime in. I posted the video of this up, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Post a video up and somebody goes, it's just like I have two cats that'll do that. One of the cats will have something, the other cat will kind of come over and the cat will kind of give just a little bit of resistance before it lets the other cat take the food or the toy that it wants. So that's what we saw here. The other one was trying to keep it away, but when it came down to it, it gave it up. And it was weird because after the fact, the one, we'll call it the submissive one, went up in the corner of the enclosure and just kind of sat there like it was sulking. Like there were crickets everywhere. It could have went back down and grabbed another cricket, but it was like, all right, I'm done. I'm just going to hang here for a bit. And then later on, I came down. It was sitting out by itself eating a cricket. Also, important note, there were crickets everywhere. They passed crickets. We'll call it the dominant one actually kind of booted a cricket away during one point when it was trying to get the cricket from the other spider's mouth. What would have been easier, honestly, in that instance? It would have been a lot easier to go, all right, let it have the cricket. I'm not going to waste energy trying to get it from it. I'm just going to grab this one that's literally sitting here right at my feet. There was a nice big juicy cricket. There was actually a couple of them around. So it could have easily have grabbed those other crickets, but it did not. Now, it obviously knew the cricket was there because it kicked the cricket away. It batted it. It felt it. It jerked its foot and the cricket ran off. So why was it going for the other cricket? Well, that points to, and again, for the people, the naysayers out there, because somebody's going to hear this and start going off, this is just my opinion, my hypothesis about what was going on, but it was more like it wanted that cricket. That is a dominant type behavior. That is a dominant type. If you watch dogs sometimes, they will go, I've had dogs that will abandon their own food bowl to go grab somebody else's food bowl. That's a power play. That's, you know what? I have my food bowl over here and I would like your food bowl as well. So is that, could there be other interpretations? Absolutely. This is just my interpretation of, but it sure seemed to me when you have crickets all around you that you have to go for the one that somebody is already holding on to. That is going beyond just, hey, there's a limit, there are limited resources here, so I'm going to take your resources. That is more like, hey, that's my cricket now. You're going to give that to me. And even the way the spider acted after it took it away, it kind of walked away and ate the cricket. The way the other spider acted was submissive. Like, all right, I'm done. I'm moving out of the way. It was almost like its feelings were hurt. I felt kind of bad for it. I wanted to drop another one right to it, but I was too excited about the whole footage thing. So that's something that I think is beyond fascinating. I spend a lot of time with spiders. Let's call it as it is. I've been doing this for many years now. I have a room full of tarantulas, and I spend a lot of time up here observing them. So again, this isn't like I walk in the room, I throw a bunch of crickets out, I go downstairs. I'll sit there and watch them. I observe their behaviors. And obviously with the communals, I've been spending over the course of the years, more hours than I care to admit, just sitting back and observing them and watching them go. So to see something like this for me, beyond fascinating. I mean, I literally came down, I went upstairs, I immediately uploaded the raw video to YouTube so I could show Billy on the big screen TV, and we watched it a couple times, what was going on. She was as fascinated as I was. I mean, my thought on it is, in a way, this kind of forces us to rethink everything we think we know about tarantulas, especially tarantulas kept in a community, because this is, the way I see it, an example of hierarchical behavior. This is, and we've seen other instances. There was one where an older food fight where one of the tarantulas came out and tried to grab the cricket from the other one, and the one on top basically kicked it off with its back legs. It was adorable. It was using its hind legs, like, get away from me, just kind of shoving it off, and the other spider went a different way. I've seen situations, there was one where I caught video of the two spiders were together, and one of them was tapping the other one kind of hard, like almost like you dribble a basketball, but just picture like two dribbles. And it was like tapping its abdomen, and the other spider, the one tapping, seemed to be posturing over the other spider, who meekly kind of eventually walked away from it. So we've seen examples, and this is the deal. When you have any type of animal living in a social group, there is usually going to be some type of hierarchy. I mean, I raised goats for years. We had, you know, the goats that were the head goats, who were the alphas, for lack of a better term. We have four dogs. There are dogs in the house that the other ones know that they're kind of in charge. We don't have any friction because there's a nice little hierarchy in there. And this seems to be a situation where in these Balfouri communals, in the successful ones, they do establish a hierarchy. There are ones that are seen. And the neat thing about this is, and one thing I want to point out, which is very interesting, I'm pretty sure that the one that got the cricket taken away from it was actually the larger of the two. So this isn't even just a larger one bullying a smaller one. This is two, in the very least, exact same size spiders. I actually think the one that got bullied was the smaller one. They're the same size, so this isn't something like, I'm bigger than you, I'm taking it. This means there is something beyond that in there. They have already established that pecking order, and the one taking it is higher up on that pecking order than the one that it took it from. I think it's mind-blowing, and it's nice because I did post this video up, and again, I only mention videos when I think it's something that people that are listening to me talk about it would benefit from actually seeing it. I think hearing me talk, describe it, and actually seeing it happen in action are two totally different things. You kind of have to see this to believe it, because you can see those little fangs coming out, you can see it grab that thing and walk away, and then you can see the two, you know, basically go two different directions, and nobody was harmed in the process. Amazing stuff. And I put the video together. I did run some clips of earlier stuff I've caught, you know, food fights. I had one with just the babies kind of eating something and not really fighting, but you can see them kind of pulling on a roach and one pulling it away from the other one. I had the one where the one came out of the hole, tried to take the cricket from the other one. The other one just kept kicking it off with its back legs. And then I had the big food fight where one of them ran out, grabbed the other one, tackled it, took the cricket, and they both walked away. I feel like a broken record. I apologize, but just, I'm floored, amazed by it. I do hope somebody at some point studies these guys more closely, because obviously this isn't going to hold up. The science community isn't going to look at this and go, yep, this is scientific. There are still folks out there that flat out do not agree with a communal in any shape or form and do not believe that the tarantulas can be communal, which really, it's starting to become irritating, because it's one thing when we first started this about 5 years ago, I thought there was good compelling evidence out there that it could work, but there wasn't a lot that tracked it to completion. There wasn't, as far as I knew, anybody that set up their M. Balfouri communal and tracked it over a 5-year period. And now we've got 5 years, we've got the vast majority, not everybody, and that's important to note, the vast majority of people that have kept them have reported that they've done well. A lot of people have seen stuff like this in their communal setups. We have compelling evidence that they don't just get along, they don't just tolerate each other, that they're social, that they can benefit from it. And the fact that there's people out there right now that refuse to even look at it, that's just ridiculous. That's just willful ignorance. So every time I put one of these up, somebody will post it on a board because they love trying to, you know, kind of get the go to the people that don't agree with it. And they put this stuff up and they come up with their responses where they're just going to end up eating each other. And the same canned response, like, for crying out loud, open your mind, open your eyes, look at the evidence. There is a lot to see here. So unfortunately, until somebody actually studies it in the wild or a maybe it could come down to somebody in a scientific environment, a university, somebody looking for a paper could raise some of these guys up and study them in a lab type setting. So maybe they would go, all right, it's not some guy that makes YouTube videos on it that they think I'd somehow benefit from posting this stuff up. It's somebody that is, you know, obviously scientific motivated that's doing it. Maybe that would get some people to open their minds a little bit, because I do think, at this point, it's probably the most rewarding thing I've done in the hobby, to see this type of stuff, to be able to catch this footage has just been amazing. And to catch it 5 years later, like, it was kind of, I don't want to say the communal had run its course, but we had been 5 years, they were doing well. I don't see them out all that much. It wasn't like it was 5 years ago where I was in here just staring at the thing constantly. To see this far along shows we have so much to learn about this. And until somebody actually takes the time to study it, you know, scientifically in a lab type of environment with controlled situation, I don't know what the experiment would entail. Maybe it's just a matter of, you know, filming them 24/7 in a lab and taking notes and seeing what happens. I don't know. But until then, we'll still have the people that sit back and go, yep, you're going to end up with one fat spider. I just don't get it. I honestly struggle with it because I struggle with ignorance. Not people, and that has nothing to do with how much brain power you have. I'm talking to people that don't want to find the information or have misinformation and continue to act on it, even when they have experiences or other people have experiences that indicate that their mindset is incorrect. That drives me nuts. That's the willful ignorance. The fact that I am going to stick to this point, even though there is compelling evidence that goes against my point of view, that drives me nuts. And just obviously, you can tell by the sound of my voice, really irritates me. So unfortunately, until we really get, you know, somebody to study this, and even then, I got a funny feeling some of these people are so closed-minded, they're never even going to look at, but I just can't imagine appreciating and loving arachnids and tarantulas as much as some of us do and wanting to ignore the possibility that this is a real thing, that they can live communally, that they can benefit. And not only that, that they exhibit signs of social intelligence. That right there is huge. That right there is monumental as far as I'm concerned in our understanding of tarantulas, their intellect, and what they are able to do, because that shows that it's beyond just the primitive eat, hunt, hide, whatever we think they do. They just kind of come out, they eat, they go back and hide, that there's no reasoning whatsoever. That shows there's got to be something there, because again, something that had that limited social intellect would just have eaten the other spider. It would have been, all right, I'm hungry, there's food, you don't want to give me your food, I'm taking you as food. And instead, what we had was a peaceful resolution to this friction. That's just insane. So hopefully somebody studied, that would be my big hope, that, you know, before the day I finally kick off or stop doing this, that somebody studies this stuff and gets some compelling information. I'd be willing to share whatever I've got with anybody doing it, because somebody else was, you know, somebody, one of the commenters pointed out, you know, you should share this with somebody. So I may send it off to some people and say, hey, what do you think about this? What, could we get something going? It needs to be studied. We need to know, because it'd be nice to, with the M. balfouri, to recognize that they are truly a communal spider. Maybe examine some of the other ones, like the N. insi or the H. villicella ones that we know that have successfully lived together in communal arrangements. But again, hate to spend the whole first part of the, I don't hate to spend the whole first part of the podcast. Now, this is something that interests me, and I think it should interest everybody. So again, if you'd like to pop over, the video is up. I think the video does, it's not great footage. I want to point that out. I had some guy come on. It was like, come on, man. He's like, it really would have been nice if you could have gotten some HD footage of this. This is really not very terribly good quality video. And it's like, I'm sitting in my tarantula room, I'm feeding them. If I had opened that cage to get a better shot of them, who knows what would have happened. It is what it is. Obviously, he wasn't on my, he isn't familiar with my channel, the fact that I'm not about posing them or taking them out for photo shoots. And I was trying to explain that. And he's like, but still, anyway, check it out. I think the footage, although it's not the best footage, you can definitely see what's going on, and it's compelling, and I'd love to hear people's feedback on it. Or the other thing I'd like is for people to start chiming in with their examples of communals, because I know a lot of people have them now. What have you been seeing? What are they like? You know, we had a couple people come forward that did not have successful communals. I think that needs to come out. I think we can't just pretend like they all magically work. They don't. I would say, I mean, just a rough estimate, I'd say probably about 90% of the people I've spoken to over the years that have set them up have had complete success. And then a couple people have lost one here or there, not sure if it was due to cannibalism. And then we do have that very small percentage of ones that it just doesn't work out. And that's fine, because like, as I've pointed out before, you can have any type of animal that you can, even ones that are known to be social, like dogs, and put them in a group, and you can have friction, you can have fighting, you can have animals that are just not compatible. So I'm assuming it can happen with tarantulas, so it doesn't surprise me. People need to be aware of it, because there's nothing worse than people going out, spending all this money on spiders, setting them up, and having a bunch of them die, and being like, what the heck? Why do people tell me this work? They need to know there is a risk. We got to make sure, you know, we talk about that. But I would say that overall, there's compelling evidence that Monacentropus balfouri are quite social, that they have exhibited signs of social intelligence, and that, you know, it's something we really need to look at more closely. All right, well, keeping on our theme of blue, we are going to go into care for the oviloscopies. I believe I said at the end of last week that I would cover that. Again, I like doing the individual spider care podcast, whatever you want to call them, where we just focus on the care of one species. I enjoy doing them, but I also recognize that for people that aren't necessarily, that don't have that species or aren't interested in that species, it's like a wasted episode for them. So I try to mix those up here and there. I have people that are like, can't you just do those every one? I like to mix it up more. The podcast allows me to mix it up more. And with the care, you know, I just did the care video on the oviloscopies as well. What I like is that I can kind of expound upon some of these points a little bit more, which makes it a little, you know, a little more free-flowing, a little more of a discussion than just the videos where I just got to hammer out all my points as quickly as possible in the amount of time that I've managed to catch footage of the spider out and about. So oviloscopies, or the Singapore blue, is one of those tarantulas that when folks first start getting into the hobby and make the discovery that there are actually blue tarantulas out there, they're usually one of the ones that make the list of ones they want to acquire. Everybody loves blue tarantulas, so you get the, you know, C. lividus, the P. metallica, the oviloscopies, the M. balfouri, all the blue ones make that list. And then usually what happens is people start doing a little more research and find out about old worlds and realize that the oviloscopies are not only old world tarantulas, they're not only big old world tarantulas, they're not only big old world tarantulas with a nasty bite, but they're also quite fast and moisture dependent. So a lot of people will end up going, you know what, I'm going to wait on this. And that's what I did originally when I saw them. I really wanted one. And I'm like, let me hold off. But finally, I felt ready for one. And I ended up picking up three slings from Jamie's tarantulas. I believe they were from her big female. I want to say her name was Madame Blueberry. That always stuck in my head. I always thought it was a cool name. But three slings in 2014, 2015. I think it was more late 2014. I've been trying. I went back to my notes and they weren't complete on this. But it was right around the winter time and that at that point. I set them up. This was back when I was putting just everything arboreal into 32-ounce deli cups. But in the case of the oviloscopies or Omothymis species, you must keep in mind that they dig quite a bit as slings and even as juveniles and sometimes even right through young adulthood. So a lot of folks will pick these guys up and they will set them up in arboreal setups with like an inch of substrate. The spiders want to dig, and plus it's a moisture-dependent species. So for moisture-dependent species, the idea is more substrate is better because that makes sure the substrate doesn't dry out as quickly. So if I have 1 inch of substrate in an enclosure, that will dry out much more quickly than 3 inches of substrate in a moist enclosure. So that's one of the reasons why we want to give them extra, plus the fact they will use it. They will dig. And mine did dig quite a bit. They were almost, actually, honestly, you'd classify them as fossorial when they were slings. They dug right down the side. They know that they create these little silk socks to line their burrows. They're quite thick. So I always like to point out when rehousing, don't be surprised if you go to dig the tarantula up and it's in like a, basically a silk sock, which can make it easy to move because they will hunker down in those silk socks and you can kind of take a spoon and just pick them up and put them in the new enclosure. Or sometimes it can be stressful because you can't find the spider or they shoot out of the sock. So just keep in mind that it's in there and be willing to work with it when you discover it. So they grow quickly. I did feature this species on my fastest growing species list. And this was, I believe, one of the listener or the viewer choices where people chimed in and said, when I asked them to vote what their fastest growing tarantulas were, oviloscopies was on that list for a lot of people. They went from about in maybe a 3/4 of an inch or so to about 3 inches in 7 months' time. So that's really fast growth rate. And it was time to rehouse them at that point. So unfortunately, they outgrew those 32-ounce deli cups rather quickly. We ended up moving them into these large plastic totes. They were about 7 inches wide by maybe 9 inches long by about maybe 8 inches deep. And again, I gave them plenty of substrate to dig in. Moist substrate is the key with these guys. I gave them cork bark hides leaned in a corner, like at a 45 degree angle, like it would for the arboreals. But I didn't really, it was more like a quasi semi arboreal setup, if that makes any sense. It wasn't a full arboreal setup because I knew they were going to dig and I didn't want to waste the space up top and set all that stuff up. No, they weren't going to use it. And I figured they weren't going to be in those enclosures all that long anyway. It was one of those deals where I just had to get them out of there and into something bigger. In retrospect, I probably could have immediately put them into their adult enclosures. Once you get them, when you have the large, fast-growing arboreal species and they hit that 3-inch mark, there's nothing wrong with dropping them in a larger enclosure as long as they have, you know, plenty of space to hide, some foliage and some, you know, deep substrate in this situation. But I did put it into something smaller. And then what ended up happening was they outgrew those ones rather quickly. So in January of 2016, I moved one that actually by just blind luck ended up being a female into a large Sterilite box. So it's about 4 gallons or so. They're the ones that are meant to use, like you can hang files in them. I've used them for a while for my medium-sized large arboreals. I moved her into one of those. A little trivia, this was actually the first video that Billy shot for me on the Thomas Big Spiders channel. Usually I had my kids holding the camera when I did rehousings, but being a fast old world, we went and did it in the garage and I had Billy on the camera. So a little trivia for you there, and she did a great job of it, and obviously because she's done it ever since. But we put her into that one, and I this time didn't give her as much moist substrate. It's something that I would change in the future, but I put in about 3 inches of moist substrate. I put a cork bark hide with some foliage on it and a plastic plant. I had the cork bark hide leaned at 45 degree angle into the corner. I put some moss behind it and gave her some spot behind it to kind of build her burrow. And at this point, I thought she would be large enough because she had hit about 4 inches or so at this point, 4.5 inches. I thought that at this point she would outgrow some of her burrowing and be more out in the open. I was definitely wrong. So what she ended up doing was taking residence behind that cork bark, and she kind of dug underneath it right to the bottom. So right through the 3 inches of substrate, burrowed, kind of built some web curtains around it, and she spent all of her time again underground. So she was not ready. And unfortunately, the setup I gave her probably wasn't completely appropriate. I mean, she did okay with it. She made do with it, but I should have given her much more substrate, deeper substrate, and allowed her to full bore burrow if that's what she wanted to do. Now, as for the other two, they both matured out male around I think it was right around 14 month mark. So that's really fast growth for a male to mature that quickly. And that's back when my temperatures in the tarantula room were much lower. We're talking about they would hit 60s, high 60s in the wintertime. So they still got that fast growth rate out of them. Know that males are sexually dimorphic. The males are gangly. Billy said they look like alien or xenomorph face huggers, and they have like a greenish overall tone to them. So you'll know if you get a mature male, you're going to recognize it rather quickly because it's going to go from being, you know, kind of a brownish looking spider with maybe some blue hints you'd think you see, and then to these gangly green things. But I had one that was supposed to go out to breed. Someone was interested. I lost track of them and didn't end up going out to breed. And I ended up keeping them in my care for many months afterwards until they both passed away from old age. So fast growing female at that point. I believe she molted right after that and hit around 5 inches, 5.5 inches or so. So within, 14 months time, 5 inches, that is really good growth rate. Now for my female, I kept her in the Sterilite thing for about a year or so. I think it was January 2016 to February 2017. So a little over a year. And what happened was, I didn't like the fact there wasn't as much room in there. This is a potentially big spider. There wasn't as much room as I would have liked for her. B, I had a situation where I started getting more mold in there. And then what ended up happening is I have my bottle that I quote unquote make it rain with. I had gone to add moisture to her substrate. I put the bottle in. Well, when I had filled it, I hadn't screwed the top on completely. So as soon as I squeezed the bottle, the top popped off and I flooded the enclosure. And there was no way to get the extra moisture out of there. So it's like, all right, time for rehousing. So what I did is I moved her up into one of the extra large critter keepers. These are a bit bigger, about, I believe if you do the dimensions of them, they're about the equivalent of a 5 gallon aquarium or so, or 5.5 gallon aquarium. So slightly larger than the other one that was probably 3, 3.5 or so. And I set it up the same way. This time I had the fake plant in there. I had the cork bark leaned in a corner. I tried to give her a little more substrate, but it was still about 3, 3.5 inches or so. The substrate, by the way, one thing you want to keep in mind with substrate is this is the point where a lot of people start experimenting with what they use. Originally, I had her on cocoa fiber. It was drying out too quickly. This is when I started mixing my own, where I used topsoil. I used topsoil for a bit. And my big issue with topsoil is I would go to add moisture to it, pour water in, and the topsoil would just puddle and mud up on the top. It wouldn't really sink down that well. So the third time I did a mixture of topsoil, peat, and added some vermiculite in so that when I did go to moisten down the substrate, it soaked in really well, much better than it was before, and it tended to grip it down in those lower levels, which is what you really need. So we set her up very similar enclosure. again, to critique myself, not what I would put her in again. I think for some species like Pisolatheria, these types of enclosures work. Mine are out quite a bit. And one of the things is you want to see your spiders out more, but you also want to give them room to hide. So I haven't used for a long time the cork bark rounds, because a lot of times they go into those cork bark rounds, you never really see them out, or you don't see them out as much. So I gave them the flats, leaned in a corner that they could build a burrow behind it. They put up some curtains, some web curtains, some dirt curtains, and then I see them out a lot more. Pisolatheria don't seem to mind. I'm looking around the room right now. The majority of mine are right out in the open. However, with Oviolosbes or other Omothymus species or Lampropelma species, they like their privacy. And what happens is if you don't give them a den that they can really feel 100% secure in, if you don't give them some extra foliage so they can go out and explore and feel like they have cover, then you have a situation like I had with mine, where I did not see my Oviolosbes in 3.5 years. I caught 20 seconds of quick footage of her scrambling around because the light was on her, and then maybe caught her sitting out in the corner of my eye twice. And we're talking about, oh, there she is. I can just kind of see her. And I go over the flashlight. She was gone. So didn't see her at all. And I think that was because of the setup. So I would encourage people, and this is something I've learned from my mistakes, that if you set these ones up, go overboard. Give them extra foliage. If you're using, this is one that I'll talk about in a moment. I moved her into one with real plants. Real plants would be a good thing. A bunch of real plants to hide behind. Give them the cork bark rounds. Give them maybe more choices. Give them a cork bark round, a cork bark flag. Give them many places to try to hide behind. The more places they have to hide, the better places they have to hide, the more secure they're going to feel, and the more you might actually catch yours out and about. So February 2017, she went into this critter keeper. She was in there for quite some time, but after I started upgrading my enclosure shortly before we moved from the old house to the new house, the big push was on to get these guys into some beautiful enclosures. I started putting plants in some of them. I bought a 12 by 12 by 18 Exoterra mini tall. Hopefully I got that right. Somebody tore me apart on one of my videos because I always mix up the Exoterra models. But it's 12 inches by 12 inches in the base, 18 inches high, the arboreal ones. I bought one of those for her. And then recently, about 3 weeks ago or so, we finally moved her into that new enclosure, which I think is absolutely appropriate for. I did put a golden pothos in it. I did let the golden pothos acclimate for quite some time, over a month in the enclosure. I kept it under a window, so it was getting nice growth. So there's a lot of extra foliage in there now for her to hide behind. I used a cork bark round this time, which is different from before, and I shoved some moss inside the cork bark round and behind it. So if she wanted to, right now she's behind the cork bark, but if she wants to go in it, she could go in it. So we have that covered. As far as substrate, I have it pitched from the back down to the front. So in the front, it's about 3.5 inches deep. In the back, it's probably closer to 4.5 or 5. So she's got extra substrate, and I kind of planted the cork bark round in that. So if she wants to go into the cork bark round and dig beneath it, she has that opportunity to do so. Much different enclosure. We did the rehousing. She was actually very well behaved. A little tricky getting her out of the old enclosure because she kept trying to hide. She wasn't standing her ground. She wasn't bolting. She wasn't throwing up threat postures, but she did not like being exposed and out in the light. We got her into the other one, and I will say that she's been in there for a couple weeks now, and I look over right now, I can kind of see her poking out. She has been more visible. So I think that goes to show that for some of the species, the more coy ones, the more shy ones, the trick is to give them more places to hide, which sounds counterintuitive to what you're trying to do, but if they feel comfortable and confident in their enclosures, you're going to catch them venturing out more, and that seems to be the case with her. So as far as max size on these guys, I've never been able to get a molt to actually spread out and measure on mine, but I did get her against the glass the other day. She was not completely spread out, and she was close to 8 inches, so I'm guessing she's around 8 inches or so. I talked to a buddy of mine who had a 9-inch female. This is one of those species where people will talk about 10 inches or 11 inch females. Is it possible? Again, I never say never. I suppose it's possible to get a 10 inch one. I think 8 to 9 is definitely reasonable. And if anybody has a 10 inch one, please feel free to chime in. Again, I'm not saying it's not possible. I'd love to hear or see pictures of it, but I just don't think it's as probable as most people are led to believe when they first start doing research on these guys. Now, one thing to point out, unlike other species, they are very leggy. And that's, I think, the surprising part for me is the body length of mine is actually not that big at all. More like a juvenile, somebody. It would be like a juvenile Pisolatheria species. But the legs are very long, lithe. They have those slipper-like feet in the front ones, which are adorable. So they almost like the huntsman in a way, where the huntsmen are very leggy. It's kind of like that. So a lot of it's in the legs. So it's not as much a beefy spider. Like if you took a ovilosipes and put it next to, say, my P. rufolata. The rufolata is about the same size, but much bulkier, believe it or not. And again, P. solitaria are thinner, more lithe species. So something to note on them, but still, I caught her on the glass the other day and it was like, wow, she looks kind of small. But then I put my hand up to her and I was like, oh my gosh, she's a gangly one. She's very, very leggy. So something to keep in mind. So with this species, this is one that many consider to be a true, if there's such a thing, I'm not going to get into the debate of it, but if there's such a thing as an expert level tarantula or an advanced level tarantula, this would be it. And that's because, again, they are big, they are fast growing, they are old worlds, which means they pack very potent venom in their bite. So if you should screw up and get bitten, it's not going to be a good experience. And the moisture requirement, they are considered to be one of the true moisture dependent species. So you put those all together, you have a spider that can be difficult for somebody to manage, and you got to worry about the humidity, quote unquote, humidity levels or moisture levels, which tends to drive people nuts. It can be a little bit difficult for some people. The good news is they are, again, fast growers because they are great eaters. Mine have always ate great. I would drop a cricket in, it would be gone. I wouldn't see them. I'd never see them hunt, but they would eat. When they were babies, I was giving them, or when they were spiderlings, I was giving them small crickets or small roaches. Once they get to the juvenile stage, like 2.5 inches, 3 inches, I could drop mediums or even a large one, they'd eat it. Now I drop 3 or 4 large crickets in with mine or large dubia. Remember, as far as feeders are concerned, roaches work fine, crickets work fine. The trick with superworms, or the problem with superworms, is the fact that you have to crush their heads because they can bite. If you don't crush your heads, they burrow and disappear. If you do crush your heads, they kind of lay there and play dead. So you almost are forced to kind of tong feed, or at least put it in a place where the spider is going to be able to find it. Same thing with mealworms, but they can work. Dubia roaches, same thing. You want to, they tend to burrow and hide. So I always like to crush their heads and they run around like little zombies. It's gross, but it works. As far as temperatures, as I alluded to before, in the wintertime, they were the high 60s to low 70s back in the day. And then in the summertime, it would hit the upper 70s to maybe 80, 82 degrees on occasion. Now that we're in the new house, I will say it's a lot warmer here in the summer. We're looking right now, I'm looking at the thermostat on the wall, and it's already 79 degrees. So it'll probably be 84, 85 degrees in here today. We have hit close to 90 before, which it doesn't stay that way very long at all, because I do have an air conditioner that I run if it gets too hot, just to knock it down a little bit, because I have seen signs that some of them do show some signs of stress when it gets way too hot up here. But much warmer temperatures, which has been great because the growth rates over here have been through the roof. Now they're all growing much more quickly. So this is a species that recognize doesn't need extra heat. I've seen it said that they are one of those species that requires an extra heat source if it gets too cold. I have not found that. All three of mine, you know, I had the males mature in 14 months with lower temperatures during the winters. Two winters they were alive, it was lower temps. So they did perfectly fine. But if you do have upper temps or higher temps, expect faster growth rates. So I wouldn't worry about that. And then humidity, again, we don't measure humidity inside the enclosures. You want to keep the substrate moist. You want to make sure that the substrate's moist at all times. You want to make sure the lower levels remain moist. The top levels can dry out a bit. That's totally fine. It's one of the mistakes a lot of us make, is we find out these things need to be kept moist and we notice that the top starts drying out and we freak out, we pour more water in, the top dries out again, we pour more water in. Next thing you know, we have mud and we've created a terrible environment for our tarantulas. The trick is to moisten it down, let it dry out a little bit in between, not completely, keep those lower levels moist, but when that line that shows the dark substrate that's moist starts to dip down too low, then it's time to go in and add some more. And a lot of times you can squirt it right around the edges of your enclosure to make sure that it trickles down and goes into the lower levels, seeps in there, gets trapped there, and then as it's released, that naturally raises the humidity inside the enclosure and make sure the tarantula doesn't dry out. And as far as feeding schedule, pick a feeding schedule that works for you. I have people that kind of go by mine, and I have my own way of doing things with slings. I usually feed them, you know, twice a week or so, because I'm trying to grow them out of that sling stage as fast as possible, because that's where they're a little bit more fragile. As they hit the juvenile stage, it's usually once a week. And now my general feeding, usually I feed everybody once a week. Sometimes it's once every 2 weeks or so. Usually once, it depends. It goes back and forth. Sometimes I'll go 2 weeks without feeding them. I go around. I do make sure everybody's water bowls are full. So even if I skip a feeding week, I do go around, make sure everybody's all set and check on them. And one of the reasons I do feed them so often, because I know there are people that feed theirs once a month, is because it allows me to go and inspect the enclosures, make sure I can take out any boluses, check for any mold or any, you know, things that I don't want in there, check my spiders, make sure the water dishes are full, make sure they have moisture, all of that stuff. So that's why I like to do it weekly. But pick a schedule that works for you. There's not, I've had people freak out like, oh, I couldn't feed my spiders last week. They're going to be totally fine. Again, I have buddies that feed theirs once a month and they have perfectly healthy spiders. So I think that about covers it for Ovialospies. Big takeaways are there. I've talked to a lot of people now. The majority of them are quite shy. If given the space, they're going to hide. They're not. They don't want to be out in the open. They don't want to be spotted. And if you do jiggle the enclosures, they'll usually go bolt and hide. They are moisture dependent. You want to make sure you keep that substrate moist. Also, I can't believe I didn't mention this. I always include water dishes with these guys. There's a water dish in with mine right now. There were water dishes in with them before. That's another thing to help control that moisture. Make sure, A, it helps with as the water dish evaporates, it keeps the inside of the enclosure more humid. And B, it gives them a place to drink from. And if you want to supplement it with spraying, it wouldn't hurt to mist them down once a week or so. Best time to do it is before the lights go out, because after that they're going to come out, and that's when they will probably grab a drink from the side of the enclosure, or maybe some of the foliage in there if you have plastic, or even real foliage in there, they can go grab a drink from that. But awesome spiders, beautiful spiders. I am glad that I do see mine out a little bit more often, so I've learned from my errors. I mean, again, the enclosures I had, it worked out okay, but I have to think that if I should have given her a better opportunity to hide and then more fully, I could definitely make improvements on that enclosure setup. I don't think she was tortured by being kept in them. I want to make that clear, but I also think I could do better. And I think with this new enclosure, I'm looking at it over there now, it not only looks beautiful and fits the, you know, the a beautiful spider, but she seems to be a bit more confident in it, which is great. So that will do it for this one. As always, if you'd like to check out, well, if you want to check out that Embalfori video, that's up on YouTube. I'm on YouTube. You can find me at thomasbigspiders.com. I've also been hanging around the tarantula forum again. I was on there years ago and was on there quite active, and I got away from it for a little while, but I bounced over there again. It's just been kind of fun to, you know, socialize and see what people have been posting, but I'm over there. As always, guys, stay safe, and we'll catch you all next time.